You ready, Doug?
Yep.
I'm going to go to you first.
Yep.
I'm going to call to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee, and it's really a subcommittee of the subcommittee. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 5012. House Bill 5012 is the Criminal Justice Commission budget. And Doug, do you want to begin?
Mr. Chair, the memo should be in front of you in that pile. Generally, there isn't a great deal of budget notes or e-board or audits. There were a couple budget notes beyond the standard Attorney General budget note that was in every single budget report for major or agencies. But another budget note was that CJC was supposed to work with the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee in strengthening prevention efforts, better defining prevention, and improving local coordination. I'm sure that the agency will talk about that some. And then there was, in a separate bill, a budget note accompanying funding for a position dedicated to performing the commission's primary function, and that is developing and maintaining the state criminal justice policy and comprehensive long-range plan. On the second page, the major issues, there are two basic functions for this agency. The first one is basically the administration of the juvenile crime prevention grants. These are grants. There should be a memo, Mr. Chair.
I got it.
Oh, okay. And their largest piece of the budget are grants that go out to the counties in terms of juvenile crime prevention. This is the prevention, the true prevention component of it. That there is also funding in the OIA budget, which you'll hear about next week, that is sort of an accompanying set of grants that go out to counties that deal more with direct services than these grants do.
Separately administered,
and but they do go, both of them do go to the counties. The budget included some cuts. Generally, the crime prevention grants were reduced by almost $5 million, or by 25% roughly. There were staff and admin cuts in this budget, both in terms of support positions and a public safety policy and research position is cut. I think that the agency will coming back and really want to look at their budget again and how the governor's budget is structured, and I believe that Ms. Gilbert will talk a little bit about that as a technical change. There was a significant cut here just recently in 5548 that reduced the law enforcement contact funding and the, I'll use the politically incorrect term, the racial profiling money that some people know it by, but that was cut significantly and by, what, about $200,000, I believe, in 5548. Yep. But there is about $200,000 left in the governor's budget for 0305, so those cuts are not rolled up. And then just another note, the same bill, 5548, they cut the grants further in that bill, but there was backfill with available federal funds so that the impact on counties was a lot smaller. But what that means is they used funds, federal funds, that would have been available for next biennium in the current 0103 biennium. So with that, the next page is just to give you an idea of what happens to the funding over time in this budget in the bar graph. The bottom part of each bar is the policy planning and admin function. The darkest bar is really the state staff that's connected into administering the juvenile crime prevention grants, and then the grants themselves are the majority of that bar, the light-colored component of each bar. And then the rest of that back includes our write-up from LFO. And with that, Mr. Chair, I've asked Mr. Lemon, the executive director of the commission, to also, as part of his presentation, to give us some background on sentencing guidelines and some of the sentencing laws in the state so that the subcommittee has a good idea as you run into Department of Corrections in the next couple of weeks and what the impact that the sentencing practices and the constraints of sentencing in the state around ballot measures and state laws have in terms of our population in the state prisons and in county jails and probation and parole. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm concluded.
Thank you, Doug. We're going to go, Phil's going to go first. Mr. Lemon, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Phil Lemon, the Director of the State Criminal Justice Commission. I want to just give you a kind of bird's eye view of what we do, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty a little later this afternoon. On the second slide of the material I handed out to you lists the statutory missions of the commission. Before I go through those, I just want to explain that the Criminal Justice Commission is a 9-member body. It's established by statute. We have 2 non-voting legislative members, Senator Minnis and Representative Shetterly. Other members of the commission include Dale Penn, who's the Marion County District Attorney, Tom Leininger, a Lane County Commissioner, who's a former U.S. Assistant Attorney, Carrie Timchuk, who is the State Director for Senator Smith, Harold Haugen, a Josephine County Commissioner, William Gary, who's a former Deputy Attorney General, Linda Moore is a private citizen from Bend, and Dan Glode is a retired Lincoln County District Attorney. All those members are appointed by the Governor and confirmed by the Senate, except the 2 legislative members who are appointed by legislative leadership. By statute, the primary function of the commission is to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of state and local criminal justice systems by providing a centralized and impartial forum for public safety policy development and planning. The way I like to characterize that is we're supposed to look at the forest and not necessarily all the trees. Our primary duty within that function is to develop and maintain a state criminal justice policy and comprehensive long-range plan. The plan by statute is supposed to include recommendations on how we use jail and prison facilities, how community corrections programs are being implemented, recommendations on alternatives to incarceration, and overall how we can assess the effectiveness of both incarceration and alternatives in reducing criminal conduct. We administer the felony sentencing guidelines and analyze sentencing trends. We administer the juvenile crime prevention grants, which are targeted at high-risk youth. We provide staff support to a variety of advisory bodies, including juvenile crime prevention, asset forfeiture oversight, and, as Doug put it, the racial profiling in the vernacular. We report to the legislature on early disposition programs. Last session, you directed each county to develop a program to expedite processing of criminal cases, and the counties reported to us, and we will have that report for you shortly. And then the kind of wraparound things are we have the authority to conduct research, provide assistance to local public safety coordinating councils in each county, and serve as an information clearinghouse. You also asked me to identify any non-statutory missions that we have, and the major one there is that we assist the Legislative Fiscal Office in preparing corrections impact estimates of crime-related legislation. So put another way, any time the legislature wants to create a new felony or increase a sentence for a felony, we use our data and contact practitioners in the various counties to give you what we hope is a very accurate estimate of how many prison beds, what the impact on probation and post-prison supervision caseloads are going to be. So you can have the opportunity to both agree on the policy and on the funding required to implement that policy to make sure that we have a credible criminal justice system that can implement the punishments that we say we're going to implement. Performance measures. All of our performance measures are new for this biennium. They have been reviewed by the Progress Board and DAS. The first 2 relate to our juvenile crime prevention program. I'm now on slide number 3. A percent of youth served by juvenile crime prevention funded services with risk factors decrease. Second is just the number of youth served by those juvenile crime prevention funded services. The third is the number of recommendations in our long-range public safety plan that are adopted or implemented. It's kind of difficult to measure your effectiveness when you're a policy development and planning body. And I'm sure when constituents ask you how you measure your success, you kind of revert back to how many bills you introduced or how many got passed and things like that, rather than it's hard to measure the quality necessarily of what you do. But that was our stab, in addition to getting the conflicting opinions on that, of course. Number 4, Progress Board was encouraging all agencies to have a customer satisfaction measure. So a percent of surveyed customers rating agency assistance good or excellent. And then, again, the fifth one is number of website hits to access our agency data or reports. And that, again, if we are producing relevant reports and relevant information that people interested in public safety want to use, then that's how we would measure that. We did have an evaluation of our juvenile crime prevention program done this biennium. We will have a more detailed presentation for you tomorrow afternoon. But I just wanted to give you the highlights of that. The general findings are that the services that are funded with the JCP prevention dollars are targeted at the appropriate high-risk youth. The statutory minimum is that the youth served have two or more of the statutory risk factors. 75% of the youth served have three or more. And the research shows that as these risk factors accumulate, a youth is more likely to commit a criminal offense or a delinquent offense. And so what this shows, I think, is that where the legislature set the threshold at two, the counties are focusing on the higher risk youth, even within that high risk group. Funded services do work to reduce the risk factors. The reductions, depending on the program and location of the program, range between 15% and 88%. More than 90% of the youth served by JCP funds did not commit a status offense, such as runaway or curfew violation, or a delinquent act, which is the adult equivalent of a crime, within 12 months of receiving the services. So considering the statutory definition of these kids being at imminent risk of committing a crime or becoming further involved in the justice system, the fact that we can prevent 90% of them from doing that, I think, is pretty remarkable. And finally, delinquent youth receiving funded services committed fewer and less serious crimes than delinquent youth not receiving those services. Our definition of prevention, and I'll get into this a little later in response to the budget note, is not limited to a youth who is either not in the juvenile justice system or in the juvenile justice system. As long as that activity reduces a risk factor, such as substance abuse or school failure, things like that, they are eligible to receive prevention funding. And so, again, what this demonstrates is that that approach is successful, even with delinquent youth, in reducing their future criminal conduct. And you'll hear more about that tomorrow. Again, just very briefly on breaking down the program summaries and identifying the major budgetary issues. One aspect of our agency function is sentencing guidelines administration. That involves both policy development, advice to a series of practitioners, and collecting and analyzing sentencing data. So after you adjourn, we take all the legislation that you have passed, we identify the issues that relate to the guidelines rules, we incorporate those through an administrative rulemaking process, and then every session we come back and have you ratify those changes by statute. So the Judiciary Committees have a chance to review what we've done and put the stamp of approval on it. The advice function, again, when judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, or community corrections officers, especially those who write pre-sentence investigation reports, have a question about how do I structure the sentence so I get to this, or do the sentencing laws allow me to do these consecutive sentences, we're generally who they call and ask for advice on that. And then finally, in the sentencing collection and data, anytime a felon is sentenced in Oregon, we get a hard copy report that has both demographic information, what the top three crimes of conviction were, and what the sentence is. We put that into a database, and then when you want to know who's being sentenced for what and where they're going, we are able to tell you that information. The second is the policy development and planning. Again, our statutory function there is to develop and maintain a statewide criminal justice policy and produce a long-range public safety plan. Just briefly, when Measure 28 was on the ballot, my commission held a hearing where we got, I think for the first time together, all the Department of Human Services agencies and all the state and local public safety entities to come in and talk about and discuss with each other what the impacts were throughout the system. And in my service in and around Salem, that was the first time that had ever happened, where you get everyone in the system to sit down and listen to each other so they can hear, for example, where people are being moved off the health plan, they no longer have A&D treatment, mental health treatment, how that affects the parole and probation population. And same with the juvenile directors hearing about some of those things. The crime lab issue that you have dealt with over the special sessions was, I think, first identified there, as was the critical reductions in indigent defense, which were really going to shut down the entire system and just lock down the ability to prosecute criminals in general. We also worked with legislative fiscal office and judiciary staff in the joint presentation early this session with both Judiciary Committees and the Human Resources Subcommittee to, again, give you more of a systems overview of how the budgets and the policies and programs of the various agencies are connected and affect public safety. A major budgetary issue there, I think, is, again, the assisting LFO with the crime bill fiscal analysis. We do not have any specific statutory direction to do that. We have no specific funding to do that. Quite frankly, when I first took this job as agency director, Larry Nicewander caught me at a weak moment, and I agreed, and I haven't been able to get out of it since. But that is, I just
we don't plan to let him.
And Doug's been very insistent on that. But that is a major effort of ours during the legislative session, where we do the best we can to accommodate the Judiciary Committee deadlines and work within this process. But we agree that it's a very important function, and we have made the effort to continue that work. Juvenile crime prevention is the largest agency program. It serves thousands of high-risk youth statewide. We have both general fund grants, as Doug mentioned, and some federal funds that we use to supplement and support this approach. The grants go to every county in the state. We also are beginning to negotiate with the Indian tribes to provide them with the same opportunities. As Doug mentioned, the grant funding was reduced sharply during the special sessions. And we also, last session, picked up some regulatory functions in terms of establishing guidelines to operate juvenile detention facilities, and to where counties want to conduct an extended detention program to keep youth up to 30 days in a detention program. We established the program criteria to make sure that they're not just locking them up and letting them sit, but there are transition programs in terms of education, meeting their other needs, so they have special needs that need to be in detention a longer period of time, that they have get those services they need and are able to integrate back in the community when they go. Two of the smaller ones, asset forfeiture oversight, does not have any general fund. It was formerly done by the judiciary staff. That was given to us in 1997. It is now a constitutionally mandated function, and by statute is assigned to the Criminal Justice Commission. Both Representative Patridge and Representative Hansen have some experience on that body. But any time, basically, a police officer arrests a person for a drug offense and they have cash, or they can prove that property or goods were purchased with or derived from that drug transaction, they can take that money and through a judicial process forfeit it to the government agency. There is obviously a fair amount of sensitivity anytime you deprive somebody of their property and property rights, and so this statute has been in place since, I believe, 1989. There have been a series of sunsets on the statutory authority to make sure it's being used appropriately. The next sunset on both the civil and criminal forfeiture laws will occur in 2005, and so that will be a major activity for this oversight committee during the next biennium. Last area I wanted to touch on was the Law Enforcement Contacts Policy and Data Review Committee. They could not come up with any kind of cute acronym, so we have to spell out the whole thing. That, again, is to address concerns relating to racial profiling and inappropriate police contacts, particularly with racial and ethnic minorities. The Oregon State Police has undergone a very substantial data collection effort to gather contact information when they do either stop or cite a person, that they gather information on that person, on the demographic information, and also what they did or did not do during the course of that interaction. We have put that into a database along with other local law enforcement agencies who are collecting data. We've analyzed that, and I'll get into a little more about that. But we have a six-year sunset on that body working on racial profiling issues. Program changes and reorganizations. I'm now on page 5. The Criminal Justice Commission was created in 1995. We've had several add-ons since then. In 1997, we picked up staffing the Forfeiture Oversight Committee. In 1999, we added the major new program of juvenile crime prevention. And I still remember the day when I came in here and my BAM analyst said the Criminal Justice Commission's budget goes up 2,000%. And it took my breath away, and it did several others, but it's a very important program. We'll get to that a little later. And then last session, we were directed to provide staff to the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee, which is, again, the racial profiling, report to the legislature on early disposition programs, and then also the transfer of the juvenile detention responsibilities in terms of those operating guidelines and extended detention program criteria. On efficiencies, cost control, and coordination, over the biennium, we have kept positions vacant. We have reduced in-state travel. We've increased use of teleconference rather than in-person meetings. And in the coordination area, I think most importantly, we work very closely with the Commission on Children and Families, with the Oregon Youth Authority, and at least parts of DHS to help ensure that the planning and grant funding distribution and who the people that we're dealing with, both the youth in the communities and the agencies at the local level, we are dealing with them in a coordinated and comprehensive way. We have a single planning and reporting process, and we have a single intergovernment agreement with the Youth Authority and the county that releases the funds, and also we link the report back to us, so we're not asking them to do basically the same thing for two different agencies. For information technology, there's not an awful lot there. We don't have any major projects, Mr. Chair. We do have a substantial use of databases for program data, both in the sentencing guidelines, the asset forfeiture, the racial profiling, and also somewhat in the juvenile crime prevention program. Our main interest in IT projects right now, frankly, is that the Judicial Department has been trying to develop and implement a uniform sentencing judgment, an automated uniform sentencing judgment in every judicial district in the state. What that would allow them to do is, as the judge is imposing a sentence, to record that electronically at the time of sentencing. They then, any paperwork that gets generated from that would be formatted the way they want it, but that information would be available electronically to transfer both to the Department of Corrections, so they have the legal authority they need to incarcerate someone or put them under supervision. We would be able, rather than to receive and enter about 12,000 hard copy reports into a database and then analyze it, we could get that information directly electronically. So we have been supportive and involved in developing that. I don't know, frankly, what the latest status is on Judicial Department's ability to proceed with that in these times, but that is something that would be a significant advantage to us in terms of getting our data electronically rather than through a hard copy format.
Bill, is it your sense? They tell us it's done, but it hasn't been rolled out. It's only rolled out in 16 of the 17 counties. Are you getting data now, partially, electronically?
Mr. Chair, no. We have asked them for that and have been told that the priority for programming us into that data transmission is not high enough on their list to make it happen in the near future.
Claire Devlin.
Chairman. This would probably be a relatively small number of cases. But with data, if the purpose in maintaining the data is the accuracy of it, we also track when sentences are set aside or when new trials are called for on appeal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, no, we do not. We don't track the cases through the system in that sense. In terms of the sentencing guidelines, our interest is more in the sentencing trends, not necessarily whether those sentences were, I mean, for the most part, they are lawful and upheld.
98%.
Yeah. I mean, most of the issues that I see in just glancing through the appellate cases, most of the challenges are based on search and seizure issues. There are questions whether you must merge convictions for purposes of sentencing, whether you can impose a consecutive sentence, but those really are fairly infrequent. And so for our purposes in terms of analyzing the sentencing patterns and trends and whether they conform with the sentencing guidelines rules, that's really not an area of high importance for us.
Okay. Go ahead, Phil.
Lastly, we've been greatly increased the use of our internet website to disseminate information and provide reporting forms over the last biennium, and that has been a significant help, I think, both to the customers that we have and people who are interested in public safety data. Budget-related legislation, we don't have an awful lot that's moving. The big ones are House Bill 2127, which would propose to transfer the Juvenile Crime Prevention Program to the Commission on Children and Families. That has not had a hearing. It does have a Ways and Means referral, so if it does pass, it will come down here. House Bill 2271 would create a new licensing fee on video game sales and rentals and fund mentoring programs through the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee. That, again, has not had a hearing, does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Senate Bill 643 would transfer funds from the Emergency Communications Account for youth alcohol and drug treatment. Again, no hearing, but that does have a Ways and Means referral. And Senate Bill 449 is a small one, but it would direct every police agency in the state to adopt a policy on the safe storage of weapons, communicate those policies to the commission. We would compile those and report to you on what the status and what those policies look like. So there's your high-flying overview.
Excellent.
Linda, are you going to walk us through the take us through the walk?
I will. We're moving now to this document for the record. Linda Gilbert, Budget and Management. On page 2 of the document, the message is that the 2003-05 governor's budget at $18.9 million total, $14.8 million general, is not far from the 99-01 actuals, especially in terms of general fund. It's just a little bit higher than that in general fund. It's a 25% reduction in general fund from the close of session 01-03 budget, and it's a 15.8% reduction from 01-03 budget through the fifth special session. Overall, there's a 20.8% reduction in the budget, again, from the close of session 01-03 budget. Positions are down 15%, full-time equivalents down 16.7% from close of session. The next page shows the budget by fund type. Certainly the majority of it at 78% is general fund, most of that being 13.8 million of the 14.8 million being the juvenile crime prevention grants. Federal funds come from the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Justice Programs. There's $100,000 a year for the Statistical Analysis Center and $3.8 million for juvenile crime prevention grants. In other funds, there's $83,440. Expenditure limitation, not the same as revenue. We don't expect that much revenue, but there is that $83,440 expenditure limitation. And that represents proceeds from forfeited assets related to drug and other crimes that Phil has already described. What this does is pretty much chew up the ending balance, but we have a little solution for that later on in the presentation. On the following page four, at a high-level view, the governor's budget is a 12.75% decrease from the 2002 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. Major changes, as Doug has already said, mostly occurred in juvenile crime prevention grant reductions as well as grants to tribes and counties. Through the fifth special session, that was at $2 million. And as a footnote, special session six did a fund shift of another $1 million, gone in general fund but shifted from federal funds, so the grants were still covered for that $1 million. Also, in special session six, the remaining law enforcement contacts committee funding was taken at $200,000. The programs and services included in the governor's 0305 budget include juvenile crime prevention grants at about 74% of the 0103 level. The Law Enforcement Contacts Committee or Police Stop Committee or Racial Profiling Committee at about 71% of 0103. There is still Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee support, statistical analysis, federally funded support, and finally support for Sentencing Guidelines Administration. The next page shows the agency by program unit. There are two. There's the Criminal Justice Commission unit at $1.2 million total, or about 6% of the budget. The other is the Juvenile Crime Prevention unit, $17.7 million total, $16.5 million total funds, juvenile crime prevention grants, and about $600,000 in personal services, $600,000 in services and supplies. And the following page six is the budget by expenditure category. Again, the big player, special payment, $16.5 million, and that would be the juvenile crime prevention grants. Personal services at about 7%, $1.4 million. Services and supplies around 5%, and capital outlay at 0.02%. The next page, seven, begins the budget building process. The adopted budget at close of session was $23 million total fund, $19.8 million of that was general fund. Through April 2002, legislatively approved actions included some one-time reductions in personal services, services and supplies, and the police stop committee, $115,000. And there were permanent reductions to the juvenile crime prevention grants to tribes and to counties, $345,887. Base budget adjustments included the roll-up of the position actions and compensation changes, $265,000 in total funds, $222,800 in general fund, and a 0.09 full-time equivalent reduction. In essential packages, there was a federal fund reduction to expenditure limitation reduction to phase out a one-time grant, and then a small amount of increase in vacancy savings. And on the next page, we talk about the policy packages in the 0305 budget. Altogether, they total $5.4 million general fund reduction. Package 81 is finalizing changes in the third special session, which was June of 2002, and it amounts to $45,913 total. It involves services and supplies as well as salary range 38 and above cost of living elimination, cost of living adjustment. Packages 82 and 91 are grouped together because they are the 2002 fifth special session. They total $5.3 million, a reduction. The juvenile crime prevention grants were $5 million, and also there was a clerical support position and a sentencing guidelines position that were eliminated. Package 90, program reduction, is $6,520 general fund, and it's a reduction in attorney general expenses to true up the budget to what appeared to be actual experience. Package 101 was a phone and rent increase. This was $12,886 general fund, and what it does is accommodate appropriate inflation and the impact of the agencies having relocated to the Department of Agriculture building during the 103 biennium. Package 102 was a redistribution of state government service charges, and it was simply to spread them between the two program units instead of having one program unit absorb them all. And in looking at them more closely, we found a $1,977 general fund reduction that we can have from that. A package that's not listed because it comes out to $0 is package 104. It reallocates $250,000 of federal funds from special payments to professional services. And what this does is true up the way trues up the budget with the way the money is actually used. So in the end, the package totals $5,392,349. The final page is a proposed technical adjustment. It does a couple of things with positions to fit the work of the agency a little bit better. The first is that it shifts funding on the research analyst from 50-50 general funds, other funds, to 80-20% general fund, other funds. And the reason is that this position, the other funds source for this position, were the asset forfeiture funds, and those are shrinking. They're not keeping up with what this position needs. So, again, and this prevents us from totally eating up the ending balance. The next change, the next two lines, there's the elimination of a half-time position and the establishment of a full-time position. And the full-time position is established at 75%, 25% general fund to federal funds. The general funds portion of this position comes from the juvenile crime prevention grants. So the net effect is that other funds expenditure limitation is reduced by about $31,000. Federal funds takes a small expenditure limitation reduction. The total reduction is $36,000. We add 0.5 full-time equivalent and bring the budget, the adjusted budget then is down in total 0.2%. And that completes my presentation.
Thanks, Linda. Questions for Linda? All right. So you want to continue?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to now go into a little more detail about what the program activities within the two budget units do and get into a little more detail on that. Our budget is divided into two units. Unit one is everything except juvenile crime prevention, and unit two is juvenile crime prevention. Within unit one, it's the sentencing policy and research, as well as agency administration. The first program area is the policy planning and agency administration. It involves four FTE in five positions, and includes our budget director, myself, a planner position, and half-time of one research analyst and half-time of one clerical specialist. That, again, by statute, is our primary duty to review both the criminal and juvenile justice systems and focusing on their efficiency and effectiveness. Again, we have the statutory requirements on how we use incarceration, alternatives to incarceration, and the effect of both incarceration and other sanctions on future criminal conduct. The activities include both the public safety plan, policy development, the corrections impact of crime legislation, which I mentioned. We do have a data analysis capacity through our research analyst, website development, and agency administration. The committee asked that we talk about the focus of our interagency activities, and this, obviously, when you're looking at the criminal justice system, we have extensive involvement in all levels, both at the state and local. We have members who sit on advisory committees dealing with community corrections, with prison transition programs in the Department of Corrections, in the prison population forecasting that's done at Department of Administrative Services, in the Criminal Justice Information Systems Advisory Board, and various research and data collection bodies. So we, for a small agency, we cover quite a bit of territory and try to keep, a bird's-eye view on the system. Performance measures, again, include the recommendations adopted from the public safety plan and website usage and customer satisfaction with our services. Just to give you a little background, 1995, the predecessor agency of the commission was the Criminal Justice Council. It was a 24-member body that was constituency-based. So we had a sheriff, a district attorney, a couple judges. There were at least two legislators. And so someone from every part of the system had a seat on this council.
It's like the board of DPSST.
Somewhat. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, because what I was going to say is that was deemed unworkable by the legislature.
Well, that's why I wanted to stop you.
Well, for these purposes, that the legislature did not view that as an effective way of dealing with this issue. And so what they did was they abolished the Criminal Justice Council, created in its place the Criminal Justice Commission. We went from 24 members who had constituency-based seats to 7 members, and the only requirement that the statute imposes on the governor's appointment authority is that we do not have more than a simple majority from one political party and that the appointments represent the geographical diversity of the state.
Senator Devlin. For DPSST or generally?
Your earlier DPSST.
Oh, I'm not actually involved in the modeling. I'm letting the policy committee fight. We're fighting enough battles down here. I figure I'll leave that one to the policy committee.
Criminal Justice Council was created 10 years before that, and basically its major accomplishment was to design and develop and implement the sentencing guidelines that I'll talk a little more about later. It also had a series of statutory instructions to conduct research and make recommendations on various aspects of the criminal justice system. When the commission was created in 1995, we got all new members, we got mostly new staff. It removed the responsibility for doing the prison population forecast and transferred that to DAS, where they have more technical expertise in forecasting issues generally, and also removed the statutory requirement that we do the crime bill fiscals. It put the research and the recommendations of that agency in the context of a long-range plan, and then also reduced the FTE associated with the agency. Last session, the legislature gave us for the first time resources to accomplish the policy and planning functions, and that was a specific planner position. The funding for that was removed in one of the special sessions, so we have not hired a person or been able to make much progress on that. I would add, though, that the governor's budget maintains this position to recognize the importance of having an overall system-wide look at the criminal justice system. And I would strongly suggest to you that especially as we're in reduction mode, that we need that kind of system coordination and big-picture outlook in order to make sure that we're not causing problems for ourselves by making inappropriate cuts in specific critical areas.
And the chair wants to interject here. Part of my concern, you'll see on my priority list that I put the Criminal Justice Commission up relatively high because I think that there's a problem with coordination. And I'm going to come back to the committee at some point in time. I've conveyed my personal thoughts to the governor's office that I think it would be appropriate for the state to move to a public safety, Department of Public Safety model with maybe input in something like the Criminal Justice Commission in order to afford more efficiencies within the system and to look at the system holistically. And I want to have some discussion about that as we move on and keep in mind some of the policy goals of the Criminal Justice Commission as we continue to move forward. I've run that up the flagpole, but I'm interested to continue to get the input of the committee, and we'll have some time to discuss that.
Well, again, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, when we held the hearing on Measure 28, the two things that were made abundantly clear were the critical reductions in the forensic labs and the state police, and how the reductions to the Energy Defense Fund were basically going to shut down way too many criminal prosecutions the rest of this biennium. And so I think you heard that message from many, many people in addition to the commission, but I think it is our hearing and our overlook of that really kind of flagged that for the first time in a formal way. The second aspect in Budget Unit 1 is the sentencing policy and research. In our budget book, it's listed as two programs, both sentencing guidelines and the Statistical Analysis Center. The Statistical Analysis Center is a small $50,000 per year grant that we get from the federal government that we use to support sentencing guidelines and sentencing analysis. So let me kind of take this opportunity to walk you through some of the other handout that I brought for you. Doug has showed you his sentencing guidelines grid. This is what I call the movie version. This reflects the summary of about 60 pages of administrative rules that establish how we sentence the majority of felons in the state of Oregon. Measure 11 and other sentencing laws kind of get all the headlines because they deal with the higher-end people, but in terms of the volume and the majority of felons that we sentence in Oregon, this is how we do it. Just briefly, the table, the other handout that I gave to you, just shows you the various sentencing laws that we have on the books, just to give you an idea of who they affect and generally how they work. And again, sentencing guidelines were enacted by the legislature in 1989, and they are used to sentence about 14,000 people every year. Measure 11, in contrast, deals with about 700 people a year. The repeat property offender law, which was enacted in 1997, deals with about 500 people a year. And then we have other pretty narrowly defined sentencing laws dealing with dangerous offenders, imposing minimum sentences for use of a firearm in the commission of a felony. The Repeat Offenders Initiative from 1990 I have labeled as Denny Smith after the measure's sponsor. Again, that is used, at least now, very rarely because we have subsumed the provisions of that in most of our other sentencing laws. But in particular, Measure 11, the way the guidelines work is we take every felony and we rank it on a scale of 1 to 11, 1 being the least serious, 11 being the most serious. So simple possession of a personal use amount of a controlled substance is a Category 1 offense. Murder, on the other hand, is a Category 11. We then take various ways of measuring a person's criminal history. Column I basically is a someone who has either no criminal history or may have misdemeanor convictions that are not Class A misdemeanors. They may have some minor criminal history, but we call them basically no criminal history. And then as you move over to H, G, F, and E, that's an increasing number of either Class A misdemeanor or felony convictions or juvenile adjudications for what we call non-person felonies. A person felony are basically things like assaults, sex offenses, robberies, things that involve the threat or actual use of force or violence. Everything else, whether that's a property offense, a driving offense, or a drug offense, are what we call non-persons. So the way the guidelines are constructed is you take the people with the least serious crimes and the least serious criminal history, and they get the least serious sentence. And then as you move up across the grid, the people with the most serious crimes and the most serious criminal history get the most serious sentences. What Measure 11 did was come in and take basically every crime, almost every crime that's ranked at a 9, 10, or 11, and impose a mandatory minimum sentence on that person. So, for example, assault 2 is a Category 9 offense. Under the sentencing guidelines, a person who committed that offense would have a presumptive sentence of approximately three years in prison. The Measure 11 minimum is 70 months. And so right there, any person who, that's an automatic 24-month sentence increase for anybody who meets that category. Under the sentencing guidelines, the numbers in these grid blocks are what we call the presumptive sentence. And if a person has, if there's a substantial and compelling reason, some of which are defined by rule, to increase or decrease that sentence, then the judge has the ability to impose either a greater or a lesser sentence for that.
If you flip the chart over, there's aggravating and mitigating circumstances that show where a judge can or can't move up on the sentencing guidelines. And there, I mean, it's the sentencing guidelines rules are complex, but that just gives you a general thumbnail sketch and overview of what happens.
And so I won't go into a great deal of detail of how they work, but the other thing I want to tell you is just the historical context in which the guidelines were developed. In the early 1980s, and this may sound a little bit familiar to you, Oregon had not built a new prison facility in about 20 years. We had an indeterminate sentencing system, which meant the judge could say, you're going to prison for up to 5 years. That person would get transported to Salem. But because we hadn't built any beds for 20 years, many people were just kind of given a ticket, say, thanks for visiting us, go back and see your sheriff. And that, as you heard, is the revolving door system. What that meant is that the state had overcrowded prisons. We were being sued in federal court. We were on the verge of losing the state's ability to control its own correctional system. In addition, judges were sentencing people to jails because they would end up spending more time in jail than if they were sent to prison. It was all done on the back end. The public did not know what was going to go on. All they heard in the courtroom was this guy's going away for 5 years, and then they read he's arrested again. There was no truth in sentencing, and even the people in the system could not rely with any predictability on how long people were going to spend where. And so one of the important elements in the development of sentencing guidelines were two things. One was some certainty, and so we wanted to make sure that the sentence imposed more closely reflected what the actual time served was. And the other was that we match our correctional resources with our policies. So in other words, we're not going to overpromise punishment. We're going to be able to deliver what we say we're going to deliver. And so that meant the policy was driving the resources. Measure 11 took that a step further, obviously, and I should add that any prison sentence under the guidelines can be reduced by a maximum of 20% through earned time credits. But that is, so in other words, the number you see here and the number you hear imposed in court cannot be reduced by more than 20%. Measure 11 took that a step further, and we now have a mandatory sentence. It is a minimum sentence, so the judge cannot go below that, can go above that if the guidelines provide for it, but that person is going to serve every day of the sentence imposed. There is no earned time reduction. There is no transitional leave or any of the other reduction or release opportunities that other inmates have. So the principles involved in the guidelines were appropriate punishment within the limits of correctional resources, and that's something you're going to hear about again as we are in these budget times and we're looking at ways to save money from the system, and also truth in sentencing, so the sentence announced in court more closely matches the length of stay, and so we're not promising punishments we can't deliver. And I think that's going to be one of the main challenges for this body as a whole, in addition to this committee, is how it approaches the corrections policy. Are we going to be up front and say we only have this much money, we're only going to do this, or are we going to try to not be so explicit in our policy choices because of the funding availability that we have today?
Or are we going to fully fund it?
Or are we going to fully, well, then, we, then we're being explicit about the policy and the budget resources.
Yeah.
So, but the other thing that I would say is that the data that we collect, and Representative Patrick has been involved in some of these discussions, as has Doug, and others will be soon, I'm sure, is where we're talking about reducing community correction supervision, parole and probation, post-prison supervision, where we're talking about who goes into prison, how long they stay, and what happens to them. The sentencing guidelines data that we use, we're developing the scenarios that say, okay, if we need to reduce the prison population by this amount, how do we do that? And so the formula that we use, again, is by the crime seriousness and the criminal history, who are the most dangerous to the public safety, how do we keep those in prison or not, for less periods of time or not, and we can model that and show you what kind of savings are generated and what, who's going to come in, who's going to go out as we make those decisions. Same thing on the probation side. If we have to cut community correction supervision, if we're not going to put people on probation supervision, who does that affect, what happens, and who are those folks, what's their criminal history, what crimes have they committed? So those are the kinds of questions that you can ask and we're able to answer for you because of this data. I've already talked about the paper sentencing reports and entering the database. We have the function involves two positions, one and a half FTE. We have a half-time clerical position who receives the hard copy reports and enters them into a database, one research analyst who ensures the accuracy of the data entry and does the analysis of the sentencing and prepares the reports. The governor's budget does eliminate the sentencing guidelines program coordinator position. In the past, that has been an attorney position who, again, provides the advice and training to the practitioners. Under the governor's balanced budget, I will be performing those functions on a reduced basis. And one of my favorite disclaimers when I go upstairs in judiciary is say I'm not a lawyer, but I played one on TV, and so that's what we're going to have working for us in that area for the biennium, assuming passage of the governor's balanced budget. The other major policy issues in this area, we do have some problems with counties who do not report their data to us. By statute, every court is required to send us the sentencing report. We have two fairly, one, the largest county that does not report is Washington County. Umatilla County is a fairly large county that we not get reports from, and there are, I think, three or four smaller counties in central and eastern Oregon who do not report. But for a statistical significance standpoint, obviously not having Washington County is a big hole. We've gone up and talked to both the presiding judge and the DA. They have stated to us that their resource limits do not allow them to comply with that statute. And so, again, we are anxiously awaiting the implementation of the Uniform Sentencing Judgment.
Representative Hansen.
Oh, never mind. I was going to ask the reason why they weren't reporting to Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, we have other counties have not been reporting. We have been able to go talk to them and convince them that.
Phil, can you provide a list to the committee of those counties that are not reporting, so that we're aware of that, so that we can take that into account when judging the Chief Justice's budget.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
And the DA's budget also.
And the DA's budget as well.
That's harsh.
I just, so the committee is aware, people are aware to some degree. I've been working on IT measures since I arrived here in 1999. I'm going to send out something on IT. My intent is, if we don't get some cooperation, to move the FTE and services and supplies into the Criminal Justice Commission, for the record, unless we start getting some enhanced cooperation. And that's my intent. Go ahead, Phil.
When we have a county that does not send us the reports, we generally have a conversation with both the district attorney and the presiding judge. The specific statutory responsibilities for the court to provide us with that information, but because most of this information is with the DA, it typically, the report comes from the DA's office on behalf of the courts, and so we try to involve both those parties. And usually we've been able to work those issues out. We do have some where we have not been able to, so we will get you that list. The next two areas are relatively small in the commission's budget and not its primary statutory functions. The first, again, is asset forfeiture oversight. That is a constitutionally mandated function after passage of ballot measure 3 in the year 2000. It is assigned by statute to the Criminal Justice Commission. It involves two-tenths of an FTE position, which is funded entirely with other funds. Originally, we had a half-time staff position for that. We had the other fund support to do that. The legislative expectation throughout this program has been that the function will be supported through the other fund process. We are able to do that even though the revenues have declined dramatically, because the ballot measure 3 that was passed by voters basically said you cannot do a civil forfeiture proceeding unless you have an accompanying criminal conviction. So what used to happen was that cop finds a drug dealer, cash in the pocket, you basically file a civil lawsuit against that cash, not against the person, it's not a criminal charge, it's a civil lawsuit against the cash, and then there typically was a default. Nobody would show up to say, it's my cash, please give it to me, so there would be a default judgment, the police agency would get the cash, and then there were other rules and statutes that applied on what they could spend it on. Passage of Measure 3 said, first of all, you have to have a criminal conviction that accompanies any civil forfeiture. Second of all, you cannot use forfeiture proceeds for law enforcement activities. And so what that meant was the funds that typically supported, especially the interagency narcotics teams throughout the state, dried up. Also, because of local budget reductions and changes of priorities, they have been less likely to go after those funds and seek forfeiture. And so as the forfeiture activity has declined, so has our other fund's revenue. But if there's less forfeiture activity, there's less oversight that we have to do, so I've been very comfortable in reducing that function. But the thing I want to point out for you is as both the civil and criminal forfeiture laws sunset next session, that was to allow a four-year period for Measure 3 to be challenged constitutionally in the courts. There is a challenge underway now in the Court of Appeals, and so we're still kind of in wait-and-see mode. But the Oversight Committee is going to be, I think, more active during this interim in preparation for those sunset discussions, also in terms of what tweaks and changes that it would recommend to increase the efficiency and effectiveness and fairness of the forfeiture activities. And so we will, I think, have an increasing workload, but for now we're okay on that. Law Enforcement Contacts Committee, again, that is to address concerns about racial profiling that have been following the public safety system and the criminal justice system for quite a while. They first serviced, I think, in a major way in Oregon in the mid-1980s when Oregon State Police had an active narcotics interdiction program on the interstate highways in particular. There were some studies done. There were a couple incidents, and that typically has generated a lot of interest. It's obviously become an issue of national interest in the last few years. New Jersey had a consent decree actually filed against their state patrol because of discriminatory acts. And so the legislature put together a package last session to head that off in Oregon. It created a 12-member body that is now being chaired by University of Oregon President Dave Frohnmeyer and has representatives both from the law enforcement community, the academic community, and the research community to try to put this in a package to look at data. It tells us, to some extent, hopefully definitively, what's going on out there, and then also provides funding for assistance to communities, cities, and counties who want to take the effort to build those relationships between their law enforcement agencies and their ethnic and racial minority groups. Cities like Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, Hillsboro have had pretty active programs, have, I think, from the testimony that the contacts we have received, been very instrumental in when you have that relationship going and then an incident happens, you've built a level of trust, people know who each other are, and there's, again, that relationship that you can fall back on when the tough times happen. And the communities that we've heard from cannot speak highly enough of building that relationship and having that in place when an incident comes up, because incidents do come up. So we have gathered testimony and information from other states and what they're doing. We have had this data collection effort in Oregon. The information that we have, we gave a report to the Interim Judiciary Committee in December, which was our first annual report. What that found is that Oregonians appear to be stopped more by law enforcement than other citizens in other states. We're not quite sure exactly what that is. It may be one of those things where we have better data on stops. And that's for all Oregonians. Minorities are not being stopped at a significantly higher proportion than they occur in the state population. But we did see some significant differences in what occurred after a police stop. They were more likely to be searched, and there were some other things that we wanted to take a closer look at. And so that's the main function of the activity of the committee in the coming year. Briefly going through the essential packages in Unit 1, this goes across all those program activities. I think Linda has explained generally what they are. They all actually result in general fund reduction, so I don't know how much time you really want me to spend going through them.
Go ahead and flip through that at that point, Phil, if those are general fund reductions. Everything within Unit 1?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so move down into Unit 2.
Unit 2 I didn't cover until page 12, and actually, Mr. Chair, it's the same story there. We have some mass transit. We have some roll-up of special session reductions. There's the kind of the traditional inflation. The main thing that I think I would point out to you is the package 82s, which are the roll-ups of the special session reductions, that in our reduction package that we presented to the governor and the governor accepted, we'd started with a proportional reduction both in the juvenile crime prevention program unit and with the other commission activities unit. We did do some balancing and trade-off there. We lost the sentencing guidelines coordinator position but kept the planner position, again, because that is our primary statutory function, and we thought it was critical. We could not make other cuts without going to that position, so that amount shifted over to the juvenile crime prevention side. We did lose a clerical position in Unit 2 as a result of that I would like to have an additional conversation with the committee about buying back a half a position, because I think otherwise we're just going to have higher-level people doing that work. We're down to a point where we really need to have some clerical support to do that, and we will do that trade.
Doug, do you have that information? Okay, thank you.
And then there are some 101 and 102 are more or less technical adjustments. The way our budget had been structured in previous biennials, we paid all the state government service charges out of Unit 1, even though they applied to both units, and so we're just trying to allocate those so we can track them a little better. So unless there are specific questions, I won't belabor you with details there. I guess the only other thing I would point out is in Package 90 reduces our Attorney General funding. The only caution I would point out there is we do have two new lawsuits from prisoners challenging various aspects of the sentencing guidelines rules. We do get billed for that, and so I'm not sure how much our historical spending on AG is going to come across, but we're hoping that those are disposed of quickly and in our favor so we don't have those ongoing
Otherwise, you're really talking a full-blown lawsuit at some point.
Well, these are, President Butler, they're, I'm not really sure what to make of them, quite frankly. They are procedural. One is a procedural challenge to the adoption of the rules. And so we're working with Judiciary Committee. So usually the ratification bill, when our guidelines rules get approved by the Assembly, it just says the legislature approved the changes to the following OARs and then just lists the numbers. One challenge says that because the Constitution requires all laws, when they are changed, to have their full text voted on, which is why you see the complete statute with the in the legislative style, they're saying that that applies to the guidelines rules as well. And so House Judiciary has the delightful task of looking through a stack of amendments about that thick and seeing the full text of the sentencing guidelines rules, about 60 pages. And so you will see the full text of the guidelines rules, and you will be voting on approving those. We're hoping that that cuts off the lawsuit and resolves any question about the validity of applying those rules. The other one is more of a technical question involving the application of a guidelines rules on house arrest and whether that affects the Department of Corrections requirements to grant credit for time served. And so, in my view, they're trying to piggyback one rule and applying it to another agency where I, in my opinion, it's not appropriate, but that's up to the judges and the courts to decide. But those, because those are challenges to the guidelines rules, we do get billed for those defenses.
Mr. Chair, to put things in perspective, this budget, the governor's budget has about $14,000 total funds in for AG resources.
But that's still a reduction.
That's a reduction, and if one of these lawsuits start chinning up the bill, it's not going to go very far, and I'm sure he'll have to readjust his budget or be back to the emergency board with asking for some help.
Okay. Always the fun thing to do. And then, I would point out that one of the special session reductions in that was bought back in the governor's balance was the planner position that was given to us in the last budget. We did not fill it, and so the funding for that was taken in special session, and basically we're doing a trade in this budget for the guidelines coordinator position because, frankly, I'm more able to devote my time and expertise to that area than I am to the public safety planning and some of those issues. So now we'll move on to Unit 2, which is juvenile crime prevention. This is our largest program area. It involves five positions.
Page 11.
Five positions, 4.4 FTE. It provides general fund and federal fund grants to counties and Indian tribes and to nonprofits for interventions with youth who are at high risk of committing a crime. Receipt of those federal grants requires a match for 1.5 FTE staff positions. And again, the purpose of these grants is to provide research-based intervention services to youth at high risk of committing a crime. The statute that created the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee and this program set out five statutory risk factors: school failure, substance abuse, poor family functioning, antisocial behavior, and associating with negative peers. I think if you kind of translate those to English, they're very common sense things that you know which kids are running into trouble and when they're going to cross the line. If they're hanging out with the wrong people, if they're not doing well in school, if they're using drugs and alcohol, then those are pretty clear indicators, both from a research standpoint and from a common sense standpoint, that these are the kids we need to focus on to keep them from committing crimes. And again, the statute requires that in order to receive these funded services, you have to have at least two of those risk factors present. And so every youth who is screened for the possibility of services, we have a risk assessment instrument that goes through and asks them a series of questions about their activities, about their family life, and that's how we identify whether they meet the statutory criteria. The planning process is integrated into every county's comprehensive plan for services to children and families. In 1999, the legislature passed Senate Bill 555 that said every county is going to do a comprehensive plan for all services to children and families. This high-risk juvenile crime prevention plan is a component of that. And so what that means from our standpoint is that we meet on a very regular basis with the Commission on Children and Families, with the Department of Human Services, with the Oregon Youth Authority. So we have a statewide approach from the state agency standpoint. So communities do a plan involving this whole spectrum of areas that they deal with in their communities with youth, with children and families. It gets put in a plan. It comes up to the state. It gets broken out. We have a joint review team with my agency and the other listed agencies where we go through and again have what we hope is a comprehensive and coordinated assessment of what the needs are and how the state funding responds to those things. As Doug mentioned, there was a tandem funding stream in the Oregon Youth Authority budget, the basic services grants. That is funding that goes to juvenile departments for basic juvenile department services such as detention and supervision and shelter care. We do have a single intergovernmental agreement with the county. So what happens is that the county designates a lead planning agency. That typically is the local commission on children and families. It can be the juvenile department or the local public safety coordinating council. In one county, we even have an education service district doing it. But the county designates who's going to run that program. They then convene the local players in terms of schools, mental health, juvenile justice, law enforcement, the whole spectrum, identify who those high-risk youth are in their communities and come up with a plan on how they would spend that money. The juvenile crime prevention plan then gets integrated into the larger plan of services in the community, and it proceeds back up to the state. We have another 20-plus member advisory committee called the JCPAC, the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, that includes members from both state and local levels, education, alcohol and drug, law enforcement. We have a juvenile court judge. We have two legislative members, Senator Clarno and Representative Knope, who serve on that. Again, these funds are, I think, in many ways different than what you see in other state agencies. They are not defined by category. You don't have to be eligible for a program, whether it's Medicaid. You don't have to be in school. You don't have to be in the juvenile justice system. You can be anywhere or any number of places as long as you are at high risk of committing an offense. And again, by statute, that means that you have two or more of these risk factors, that you are clearly demonstrating at-risk behaviors, and I think most importantly, that you are in imminent risk of entering the juvenile justice system or penetrating further into the juvenile justice system. And so these clearly are the kids who are either at or over the line that we're trying to bring back and save those system costs. And as you will hear tomorrow, we will have the evaluation presentation tomorrow and give you more information on those risk factors. But again, the evaluation is showing that 75% of these kids have at least three, and some as many as four and five. All five of these risk factors are coming to these programs. And what we think the evaluation is showing us is we're having very good success in applying these interventions and keeping these kids from committing a crime, which obviously reduces the number of victims and the cost of victims and also prevents the juvenile justice system costs from occurring. It keeps kids in school and helps them succeed there. And so we see a number of benefits all across the board and in many different program areas the state funds these funds benefit. The funds.
Are you going to provide some logic? I mean, I know your program's really only gone for a year to a great degree on
our evaluation, Mr. Chair, our evaluation has really been in place for a year. We've had basically 3 years of experience in kind of increasing and decreasing levels of funding and kind of on and off in that way. But we feel we have a good evaluation data set to come in and kind of give you not a program-by-program evaluation of what is working and what is not on a county-by-county basis. But overall, we think we have a good solid basis for letting you know how we're doing.
And I think, as you're well aware, I think the committee needs to really focus in on what's going to happen to the system should these grants go away. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, when I was still wearing a county hat, I think I was involved in some of the discussions in terms of moving this program forward.
You mean you quit wearing your county hat?
Yeah. Well, I didn't have one with the acronym BEEF on it, and so I didn't know what that meant. So I
thought that was Brotherhood of Electrical.
Yeah,
something or other.
Like
I thought you would have one of those.
I'm sure it involves some union. But anyway, one of the things we took an awful lot of time on and built in from the program from the very start was the assessment, and I think I'm going to be real interested in seeing both the quality of how that assessment is working, but I think it by now it should be giving us a tool to really be able to evaluate what kind of bang we're getting for the bucks, and I'm really looking forward to see the product.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think, frankly, this is one of the most closely scrutinized pots of money, especially in the public safety system. You've asked us to be very accountable for this money. We have an evaluation contract with the University of Oregon, the Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior. Dr. Hill Walker there is a nationally recognized juvenile crime prevention specialist. He and other colleagues there have developed very successful research-based programs on specific populations of kids that have been, I think, nationally recognized, and so we were very interested in having them come in and do the evaluation and take the lead on that. We also have MPC Research out of Portland that has a long history of evaluating programs in Oregon, particularly in the Department of Human Services, A&D things, and so we think we have a good evaluation team, and we expect you to have a good report.
Well, so often we fund things that seem like good ideas. And I think this is one of the cases that we should really be able to measure what the performance of those ideas are.
And Representative Hansen and the rest of the committee, you should know that the chairs of the two judiciary committees and your subcommittee chair have been working pretty diligently with all the department heads of the various public safety department, as well as Phil has been very actively involved, Doug Spinner actively involved, and the children, or the Commission on Children and Families, in regard to putting in statute something that will basically define the types of programs that the state is willing to fund, so that we aren't funding so many homegrown programs that sound good with no outcome measures. And this committee will have that opportunity to look at that bill, I believe.
Mr. Chair, as a former county commissioner, I don't think I ever saw any homegrown programs without any outcome results that we weren't aware of. They were good. Right?
Mr. Chairman.
They were all good, the homegrown programs.
Mr. Chairman, I've been watching part of the demonstration the lecture to the two skateboarders here by the state trooper, who's been out here about 20 minutes lecturing, I believe, a proper skateboard use around the Capitol. She's right over here. She's been out there with him for 20 minutes.
I'd like to invite that young lady in here for picking up her skateboarding kids so we can see if she has any risk factors.
She's bridge 1A,
as a guest was reading down the list of things, I was monitoring. Now that's probably one, and that's maybe a second.
Well, they've clearly come to the attention of a public safety official. Whether they're at imminent risk of involvement in the juvenile justice system, we'll have to keep watching, I guess.
The kid has a jacket that says zero on it. Put that
on. Zero. That could be the risk score. It could be something else. Basically, the way this program works is the money is allocated to counties and Indian tribes based on their proportion of 0 to 18 population in the state. Counties and tribes, eight counties and all the tribes, get a minimum $50,000 biennium grant as a minimum grant. The JCPAC reviewed it and felt that was the minimum amount of money necessary to run a prevention program within any jurisdiction.
I just need to ask Phil, are all the tribes represented? I think there's nine different represented tribes. They each get $50,000, which is the minimum.
Mr. Chair, they're each eligible for $50,000. We have one tribe that has declined to participate, and the others are in various stages of their planning or receiving the money.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler. Do you know if they consolidate those their programs with the counties in which they reside or adjacent counties, or do they actually provide their own tribal program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, primarily they do their own program. This has been an interesting exploration. I had not dealt with the Indian tribes before this juvenile crime prevention function. We have spent quite a bit of time working with the counties to encourage them to involve all their minority communities in this process to make sure that the prevention services are delivered in an effective way to the minority youth, because there are differences in how people learn and respond to different things. It has been there's been a lot of challenges there. We've had kind of steps forward and steps back. For example, in Harney County, early on in this process, the county and the Burns Paiute tribe was working very closely together. They were sharing funds. They were had, I think, a very close joint planning process. They had some different people come into that, and I think the level of cooperation and working together has fallen off. On the other hand, there's been counties where we started out with a very separate process where we made progress in terms of integrating and getting the county to work much more closely together with the tribes. And so I would say, have a mixed record there, but I don't think it's, from my understanding of how tribes relate with other governments on a variety of issues, that's not unusual. But we do make an emphasis to work with the tribes and encourage them to work with the counties. We do have had in the past a Native American member on the JCPAC, so that the tribes had a very direct voice on the JCPAC. And if you're interested in that, Becky has spent quite a bit of time going to the government-to-government meetings and to really do a lot of outreach and working with the tribes to make sure that we're trying to meet their needs as well as conforming to the program here.
Sure. I'm just anxious to know how the tribes participated, because their delivery systems and their perception of the needs and their commitments and buy-ins in some instances is different. And where they can, counties appear to be an excellent resource, and particularly where they will, like the Harney and the Paiute Nation there, that's the Shoshone Paiute. The Shoshone are in Mount Yerk County, but that's not an organized tribe. The Paiutes and Harney have different but needs, but they do associate very closely with the balance of the Harney County folks there. So just anxious to know how it works.
Are they eligible by are the tribes eligible by statute for the grants?
Mr. Chair, yes, they are.
And are the youth double counted? So if there's youth that live within Harney County, for example, do you exempt out those who are part of the Paiute tribe or not?
I believe we do.
So they're double counted.
They
probably
are. Yes, and typically those are, because they're in the smaller counties, I don't think that would have a substantial impact on how we distribute the money. The tribes are eligible as what we call minimum grant jurisdiction, so they get the $50,000. In one of our earlier special session budget cuts, because the tribes had not gotten a long ways through the planning process, one of the reductions we took was their first year funding. And frankly, that did not make me a lot of friends in a lot of places. But that money they will have the full biennial amount restored in 2003-05. What that means is what that money will come out of is the county share, and we'll have a smaller pot to distribute to the county.
So can we get a list of the youth population by county as well as what it is for each of the tribes?
Do you have the tribal youth population?
I don't believe we have that, Mr. Chair.
Request that from the tribes, please.
We'll try to get that.
Senator Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the grants were reduced lower than the level that the governor has in the budget, given some of the choices that's before the committee, and I'm not saying that we would seek any change in the statute, is the formula in statute so that, I mean, if you reduced the grants to a certain level, you'd be basically down, is the $50,000 minimum in statute?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, no, it is not. The statute directs the JCPAC to review and establish a minimum grant amount, which we have done. In light of the budget reductions through the special session, we just revisited that conversation within the last couple months. Again, just because there's less money going around, we don't see that there's any change in circumstances that really requires less money to operate a prevention program. But that would not require statutory change. Some of the things we have talked about, if funding continues to decrease, and with the discussions we've had with Judiciary Chairs and Representative Patridge, is how we would refine the program to target even on the highest risk of this group. And so we've talked about we can perhaps look at going to 3 risk factors instead of requiring 2. There are other ways of kind of focusing that population. Whether we start saying we're just not going to fund certain types of programs, we've talked about that within the JCPAC. And again, what we want to do is make sure that we're using this money in the most effective way possible. And if we have $13 million, that may be one set. If we have $10 million, that may be another set of issues. And so the legislation, or at least the outline of legislation that we've been talking about, we haven't, I don't think, really settled on an approach yet, but what we're trying to do is ensure that a larger proportion of the money, whether it's with the Criminal Justice Commission or the Youth Authority or for A&D prevention, is more closely focused on what works and the highest risk kids. And so from my standpoint, I'm feeling pretty comfortable that we do a good job of that already, If you need us to elevate that and focus more closely, I think we have the ability to do that without a lot of statutory change. But we've been working closely, obviously, with the legislators involved in meeting that interest. But so you were just asking what statutory changes might be necessary if it came to that?
That's the basic question. I've seen in some cases, not in this case, but that sometimes when you reduce some things down, basically what you end up is with the minimums across the entire state.
What's the ORS? So
417, 850, 845, and 850,
855.
Okay. Representative Hansen had a question. Were you done?
I'm done. Well, when you see the numbers on the county populations compared to the minimum grants, it looks at first blush like the very small counties are getting, you know, very rich programs because the cost per kid is a lot higher than the cost per kid in Multnomah County. On the other hand, in those kind of rural counties, sometimes they're so isolated from services. If you're going to do any service for a kid in Sherman County or Gillum County probably requires a trip to Pendleton or a trip to the Dalles, maybe even into Portland. So trying to maintain a program, even though it's for a very small base of kids, becomes incredibly expensive per kid. And that was part of the rationalization in terms of why we set the minimums pretty high when you're looking at it for population. And then kind of from a Multnomah County perspective, even if you reduce those and redistributed the money, the amount to a larger county that it would increase is pretty minimal. I mean, there's a point where in a Multnomah County or a Clackamas County that you've got both enough services that are readily available that you can get to and some levels of economy of scale that for that offset, it seems pretty rational that we set the minimums at the level we did. And I was pretty comfortable, even from a Multnomah County perspective, that it wasn't an unfair burden on the larger counties to support the small counties at that level.
Sir Devlin.
I agree with Representative Hansen. I'm not saying that cuts would ever get to that level, but when you get to a certain level, $50,000 still may do something in Gilliam County, but $50,000 in Multnomah County does nothing.
Yeah. But I.
Well, but if it's $50,000 as part of something that Multnomah County grants, or there's other private grants that go together to come together, it can make a difference in it. It can make a substantial difference in programming. Most of these programs are cobbled together.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would not say they're cobbled together. I would say it's very common to have, especially when we have a comprehensive community planning process going on, and they want to run, for example, a mentoring program. They will take some money from the schools, some money from the JCP funds, and other funds they have available to be able to fund a program that meets that need. If the JCP money
Their funding is cobbled together. Is that fair? Is that a fair analysis, Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
I feel better now. The kids that we deal with in this program basically are age 10 to 17. Those are the ones that are eligible to get in the juvenile departments. We do have a case-by-case exception that kids younger than 10 can be served with this money. The reason we do that is the research shows that the earlier a kid gets involved in the juvenile justice system, that is a real marker, no matter what they do, that is a real marker that they're likely to be in the justice system for a long time and probably by the time they're done in a very serious way. And so we want to make sure that we do have the flexibility where counties can identify an 8-9-year-old kid who's getting in trouble, that we deal with that on a quick basis and get them the service we need to turn them around. Because those are the people that the research has shown are very likely to be your long-term residents of the Department of Corrections. And the reason they're long-term residents is because they commit the most serious offenses and they get the longest sentences. There is a federal fund, as I mentioned earlier, a federal grant stream that we have combined with this. What we try to do is use the federal funds to award to primarily the counties and nonprofits to look at systems approaches to make sure that we are building and improving the ways the different systems work together. So, for example, we fund a program in Multnomah County that works to keep kids who are at risk of getting suspended and expelled in school. School success is one of the biggest indicators that a kid's running into problems and is going to drop off that ledge. And so in addition to their individual interest in staying in school and getting an education, which opens so many doors of opportunities for them, it's also we're trying to close the door on moving them in the wrong direction. And keeping them in school, even though that may cause some problems for the school administration, is research has shown again and again that that is the right thing to do in terms of preventing juvenile crime. Because you're keeping them in an activity, you're engaging them with kids who are not negative peers, they're at least exposed to kids who are not showing all the bad habits, and just, again, the academic success is a real flag on whether they're going to make it or not. So that's pretty much what I want to say about the Juvenile Crime Prevention Program right now. In terms of essential packages, we already, I think, covered those while you were out, Mr. Chair. Those, again, mostly result in general fund reductions, so I have real mixed feelings about recommending them to you and urging their passage. The budget note did have three things that you wanted us to respond to in the Juvenile Crime Prevention Program. One is the definition of prevention. The JCPAC has defined prevention as an activity intended or resulting in the reduction of a risk factor. So again, what that means is that we're not saying you cannot use prevention money for kids who are in the juvenile justice system. What we have is a prevention funding stream in the Criminal Justice Commission. We have a basic services funding stream in the Oregon Youth Authority. The basic services money goes to juvenile departments and is used for juvenile department services. We do have a waiver process where you can cross over. But the definition is, again, based on the risk factor and the risk reduction, and that is what we are most interested in.
But whatever the legislature determines as risk factors are prevention.
As long as the function reduces the risk factor. And just to give an example, we have some communities that use their prevention money to fund things like teen courts. And if all the teen court is an adjudication process that holds them accountable and moves them to do something else, they have to demonstrate to us that doing that reduces a risk factor, whether it's keeping them in school or some way addresses alcohol or substance abuse. Just the fact that you call it something is not going to meet our criteria in this.
Okay.
In the planning coordination, again, we participate in the state level Senate Bill 555 group, which is the review of the comprehensive county plan for services to children and families. We have joint planning guidelines. We have joint plan review. The Commission on Children and Families director, as well as members for the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education, are all on the JCPAC, so they have a voice in coordinating these services. And again, many of the local commissions on children and families are the lead agency for planning for these juvenile crime prevention funds. And so again, they have a very comprehensive look at what kind of services and funds are coming into the community for these high-risk youth. On the better coordination across categorical programs for common risk factors and common strategies, again, one of the important things is that these risk factors that kids have for committing a crime that's not the only problem area that they indicate. So obviously, if school success is a crime indicator, it's also a risk factor for succeeding at school. So again, what we have is a joint agreement on the risk factors among these various agencies, so we know we have these commonalities in place. We have common outcomes that are used in the planning guidelines and that get reported back to us through the planning process. And then we do see the common strategies coming back in our community plans, whether those are programs focused at school success, on truancy, mentoring, the parent-family training. Because, again, these kids do not come in with a single problem. They come with a multitude of problems, and what we're trying to do is have our money flexible enough but accountable enough where we know that money is going to the right kids and doing the right things to create the right result. The last thing I wanted to do, Mr. Chair, is to just kind of give you a little wrap-up, knowing the scope and the scale of decisions you have to make in the public safety budget and knowing what some of those holes are that you're going to have to deal with. The question I hear a lot is, why on earth would we fund prevention when we can't keep people in prisons, when we can't put troopers on the road, when we can't do this, when we can't do that? And so I'm going to try to help you answer that question in my closing remarks. The first reason is that they work. And that's what you're going to hear from the evaluation team tomorrow with a lot more specifics. But we are targeting the right kids, and we are having the right effects. And so why is that important? First of all, they reduce crime. You don't have more victims who are clamoring for more justice services, who want victim compensation, and who are calling for you to increase sentences and take more steps. Referrals to juvenile departments are down, and risk factors are being reduced. Another thing is that they do focus on the highest risk youth, regardless of what system they are in or whose services they're eligible for. You don't have to be eligible for Medicaid. You don't have to be in the juvenile department under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. As long as you are a high risk youth, you're eligible for these services. So what that means is we're helping the school system dealing with troubled kids. We're reducing alcohol and drug use, and you all know the crimes that creates. We're providing mental health services, which I'm sure you've heard is a critical area in the public safety system, whether it's on the juvenile side or the adult side. And we're keeping kids from coming into the system, and the farther they enter the system, the higher cost that they impose. So if all they do is, if they get arrested, that's one cost. If they get adjudicated, if they get supervised, if they're in detention, and those hard beds are where the big dollars are. And for those of you who saw the presentation early in session, you know, this guy went back and forth, and he got arrested, and he got booked, and he got this, and he got that. But I think as a response to your question, Representative Butler, you asked how much does this cost and where does it come from. The biggest costs were that guy sitting in jail and the time he did in the state prison. So the more we can deal with those people at a lower level, the more cost-effective and cost-efficient our expenditures are, in addition to not having the victims created in the first place, and that's public safety.
Claire Devlin.
Thank you for the presentation. Let me ask you a question about prevention. It doesn't fit under these guidelines for this program, but I'll give you an example of a program in one of our institutions I think you're well aware of, the Parenting Skills Program, particularly at Coffee Creek. Now, the children that are the children of the inmates there that are going to be let out are obviously probably in many cases in relatively high-risk situations in which the families may be or may not be, but a fairly high likelihood have some dysfunctional characteristics. In terms of prevention dollars, well, shouldn't that be a priority for prevention dollars, actually? When you compare it to, say, some of the programs that were talked about earlier where they're unsure about what the results will be of those programs versus something that you at least have some indication will be successful.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. And are you asking me in general terms or how it applies in the context of juvenile crime prevention programs in terms of the kids that we're talking about?
If we have a limited number of dollars towards prevention, should we try to preserve that, or should we try to preserve some other program that's out there that's maybe less defined?
Well, Senator, my answer would be you got to look at what the risk factors are of the kids. I mean, certainly having a tradition or a history in the family of committing crimes serious enough to land you in a state prison would be a very high risk factor. The other thing you need to look at, though, and I would doubt that this is the case, but let's say, for example, mom's a bad apple, dad's a straight arrow. The kid's with dad, doing well in school, has a good family environment. You know, the only risk factor is maybe how much he sees mom and how much he attaches to mom. So in those kind of cases, I would say, no, you don't want to do that. You need to focus on the kids who are in the community, who don't have parents who are in jail, but who are dropping out of school and smoking pot in the backyard and all those other things. But what I'm assuming we're talking about in a more typical case is where if mom's using drugs, and chances are dad is too, if he's even around, and I don't know who's taking care of the kid now, if it's a relative. I mean, the key is that child needs a family environment that supports them and moves them away from what mom's doing. And if mom's going to have custody when she comes out, then, yeah, we do need to look at that very closely. But we also need to know that the kid is the one at risk and what the kid is going to respond to, rather than just saying because mom's in prison that's the be-all and end-all of what we're talking about. I haven't, frankly, spent the time to look at that program, but I'm DOC, I think, does a pretty good job of targeting their research interventions. They have a lot of federal support to do that, and the feds are very selective about who they fund for those things. So on the whole, I would have a lot of confidence in that, but those are the questions I would ask if you're making those choices.
Mr. Chairman, the only reason I ask the question in a sense is because sometimes the question is always posed to us in terms of, in these times of choosing between prevention or actually sanctioning, and we may actually be in a situation where even whatever resources we can have for sanctioning or for prevention, choosing between prevention programs for what will be funded and what will not. So.
Well, and the other issue is, Senator, is why is Mom in there, and does she need to be incarcerated to provide that kind of a treatment service for her? And so, I mean, getting into prison is a little easier in Oregon than it used to be, but Oregon is not a real high incarceration state. And so typically you have to do something fairly egregious to get into the state correction system. And so, but one of the things you need to look at while you're there is what's happening to those people. And so I would encourage, I mean, again, I understand the decisions that you get to make, and frankly, I think I'd rather be on this side of the table. But I would encourage you to look at the risk of who's involved and what they're doing with those kids and what the outcomes are, and make sure you have a good basis to make those decisions rather than just saying these are corrections programs, therefore they are inherently more valuable than the community programs.
Senator, Representative Hanson.
In a similar vein to Senator Devlin's questions, we got into a discussion at Multnomah County in terms of where you get the best bang for the buck in early intervention or later intervention. And one of the things that occurred to me watching the system, the later interventions with kids 15, 16, 17, although they're not as effective, they're also the earliest stage of early intervention because those people very often become parents at a very early age. So when you're intervening with a 17-year-old in the Multnomah County system, quite often they're already starting families. And so if it's almost like the earliest early intervention is working with the kids just before they start a family or at the time they're starting families.
Babies and babies.
Yeah.
Bill, I don't know how complex a list of programs are that your grant streams are funding right now by county is it something reasonable to have on a, do you have quick program descriptions or not? Or
Mr. Chair, probably
they're using the grant funding.
Well, we can do this a couple different ways. We have one-page summaries of each county plan that if you want collectively or you just want for the counties you represent, we can do that. And or we can get you a list that, for example, of school-related programs, we break those out just in terms of, mentoring, truancy, and assign a dollar value that would be statewide if that would be helpful for you. So I'm not sure what it is you would like to know.
Well,
or
I think the committee needs to understand the scope of the grants and where the money's getting to the end of the row.
Well, if I can just suggest then that we'll get you the one-page summary of what the counties in your district are, or how they're using their money, and then Becky just handed me this, for example, Kojak.
I mean, all of our counties are obviously doing it right, and it's just those other counties out there.
That's always the problem.
Yeah,
it never ceases to amaze.
That always seems to be the problem in the legislature. But,
for example, we can, without breaking it down by county, we have family services, which includes family functional therapy, which is a blueprint program, which is the good housekeeping seal of approval that is very difficult to attain. Family therapy, family support services. So you
that's
can
Kojak, Central Eastern Oregon.
Excuse me, that is I skipped and did a different category.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Kojak has a variety of services that we don't have listed out, but again, with your county by county list, we can get you that detail. This is just on a statewide basis where the prevention money goes, where the basic services and the diversion funding from OIA goes. And just kind of a, for example, on school-related services, it's about $3.4 million, or was the beginning of the biennium. It includes after-school programs, court school, transitions, mentoring, boys and girls clubs, truancy, et cetera. So that'll give you kind of a flavor of what gets funded.
Okay,
to
well
what
why don't you give us that tomorrow, and then if we need more detail beyond that, we'll look at the county stuff. If you could get me a list of the county stuff, though.
so I can be educated. You want for every county or just for yours, Mr. Chair?
Well, we have. How big are they? I mean,
we have a one-page summary for every county.
Well, why don't you give me all 36?
36. I'm going to share it.
Does everybody
get to that?
Okay.
I'm going to say Representative Butler's counties are great big.
Yeah, those are great big counties, so the programs are really, really small.
And a couple of them are minimum grant counties as well.
I think they all are. So.
I don't believe all of them, but.
Okay. Great.
Okay. A couple sneak in just over the line.
Anything else, Bill, to add?
That is my comments. I'd be glad to answer questions, Mr. Chair.
Linda, anything else to add? Any further questions for the committee for Bill for tomorrow? I wanted to go over some housekeeping stuff before one packs up and runs out the door. All right. With that, we're going to continue over the hearing on House Bill 5012 until tomorrow, which is Thursday, April 10th. Without objection, so ordered. So we're going to close the public hearing today on House Bill. Okay, just on housekeeping stuff. Tomorrow we're going to try and get Phil's stuff in within an hour. Is the plan. What I'd like to do is, if everyone has copies of the list that I handed out, the priority list that I handed out before. My preference is to do this, and I wanted to get input from the committee. My preference is to kind of look at them in a straight up public policy standpoint in terms of what we've heard already. Doug and the LFO folks are in the middle of pricing all of these, but I'd kind of prefer to look at them without trying to move things around by price first. I think that maybe it's a more
you want to prioritize by the efficacy of the plan,
efficacy of the program. You know, and obviously within each one, once we get it priced, we can look at various levels of funding and what's sustainable and what's not. But my preference would be that we'll probably bring in a PowerPoint projector tomorrow, and we'll throw it up on the wall, and we'll have the ability then to talk as a committee and we'll shift some things around for about an hour on that list, and then I would come back Monday once the list is priced, just so people can see the pricing on the list and add any other further thoughts on Monday.
Well, as I've been doing some work on this the last few days, the two things that really make you here now are the statutory requirements. And it's kind of hard to make a decision in terms of if there's a statutory requirement to do something, even though it might be a relatively lower priority, I think we still have a responsibility to do it until the statute's changed. And when we don't have an idea in terms of whether the statute's going to be changed or how it's going to be changed, I struggle with how important of a an activity. The other one is on kind of on the partial funding issues, that something may be a very good idea, but there's lots of options left in terms of how fully to fund it. And some of that crosses over even on statutory requirements. So,
and I think that's part of what I'd like to do tomorrow, is I'd like to fill in those things. I'd like to fill in to some degree what we'd like to have priced as partials. I'd like to identify those categories that we have as partial, you know, that we would partially fund depending on how we built the system.
But you know somebody that can propose changes in statutes, huh?
We know a few people who can propose changes in the statute. My preference would be, I mean, there's federal constitutional issues that we have to, that we obviously don't have any choice in what we fund or don't fund. There's obviously state constitutional issues, and I don't think we can probably walk away from the legislature right now with a balanced budget that may rely on a ballot measure that goes out to fund something constitutionally. So that's kind of the direction that I was heading. The statutory stuff, my opinion is that in order to get the savings that have been kind of potentially attributed that we need to get out of public safety, we probably can't do the savings without some substantial statutory changes. And I don't know if the committee's in general agreement on that, but I think you guys have looked at the budgets close to as much as I have.
Mr. Chairman, we'd probably release some of the agreement member is very skeptical about actually getting the statutory changes.
I don't disagree, but I think we've got a. But we've been asked to prioritize a list as to what we would do or not do, and provide that information to the co-chair. So we're waltzing up the hill, and whether we're able to get those or not, if we have to prioritize a public safety system and build it, I agree with you. I'm very skeptical we could get the votes, too.
Mr. Chair, it's been, however, the history with regard to the five special sessions that when it comes down to funding, that funding amount comes in a budget bill that indicates, the statute notwithstanding, here's the amount. And I think that pretty much addresses the issue of, you know, the statutory responsibility. I guess I'm concerned about some of those kinds of things, but also recognize that given the parameters laid out for us by LFO and the co-chairs, you know, you're going to have to start looking. Is it help and take care of the general welfare of the state, and is it deal with basic education issues? And I think most everything we're dealing with here is a direct health or is a direct public safety issue for the people of the state of Oregon. So I don't know that we're going to have to do the statutes notwithstanding, but it's going to be interesting.
Senator Devlin.
I think the pair with the chair, some of those statutory changes, I don't think you would get my support on either. So.
But I want you to look at this academically and objectively is what the chair is trying to get to. I mean, the chair probably wouldn't support many of those, if not most of those statutory changes which would have to take place.
So, Mr. Chair, you also have to provide a balanced budget.
We have to provide a balanced budget, and I might fight on other fronts outside of the public safety arena to balance the public safety budget.
We could just have it at the end, Mr. Chairman, at the end of the staff, just notwithstanding ORS. Just leave it. Leave out the reference, notwithstanding Oregon revised statutes.
In total.
Yeah.
In total. Okay.
But cut down on
but
the
that's my proposal, unless, you know, I don't know how else to. I'm trying to be as open and honest and, you know, let everyone look at it as we can be. And I'm open to any comments anyone else might have to help facilitate the meeting. For tomorrow. Does that sound reasonable?
Do you want us to bring our drafts of your committee?
Please bring your priority list that's marked up.
Well,
is that what you're talking about?
Mine's from general government, Mr. Chair. Just as long as you don't make any of the cuts in general government, we're fine.
These aren't cuts, remember. This is just a priority list.
Yeah, you've got it. You got to start somewhere.
Yep.
And this seems as good a way to do it as anything, and it ends up probably you're not real happy with the end result no matter what you do. So
Christine, can we set up tomorrow so that maybe I'll sit down here and push the PowerPoint by the we'll put a PowerPoint here and throw it against the wall, and then we can just sit the committee so everyone can see. So Phil doesn't think we're weird when he comes in tomorrow. What would you like to facilitate for tomorrow? All right. Thank you, everyone. We're adjourned.